All right, welcome to Physics Frontiers. I'm Randy. You're supposed to say you're Jim.
I guess I'm Jim.
And this week we're going to be talking about photonic molecules and optical circuits.
Okay, so what are we going to do with these photonic molecules? What do you mean by that? Where are we getting this from?
Well, this is a wonderful thing that has been happening recently in the lab, and they've been able to make photons within quantum nonlinear material, a very cold gas, act as if they're attracted to one another, as if they're massive particles. They actually get bound, and they will exit through the gas at the other end at the same time. So through the material, through this photon quantum coupling mechanism, they act as if they're bound together like a molecule. So it's a metaphor, but the behavior fits with it.
Okay. Was there some interesting thing about this? Or was there some application for this that was particularly interesting, did you think?
Boy, is there. There are several things happening in this that I think we'll enjoy talking about. One is we've got now a macroscopic experiment that can introduce a single photon into a medium which is extremely cold, and where the atoms are basically bound in a highly attractive quantum mode, and that one photon can change the behavior of these 3,000 some, I believe it's rubium. What kind of atoms are they in this paper? I think they might be rubidium atoms, something like that.
Is it rubidium or is it rhodium? I didn't actually write it down. Let's see.
Yes, rubidium.
Rubidium, okay. So the rubidium atoms.
That's right, and you can change the behavior of the way that they couple together, almost like you can entangle like 3,000 of the atoms in the experiment by adding a single photon to them, so they become entangled with their polarization. And this allows you to create an optical transistor, which is basically the bedrock idea, the operating principle for a photonic circuit or a photonic computer. And then there's also another phenomenon involved, electromagnetically induced transparency, which is a fascinating field unto itself. So there's quite a lot of interesting things going on here. And of course, we've never really observed photons behaving like massive particles, moving at a slow speed, acting as if they're strongly attracted to one another before either. Because, we're used to seeing in ordinary free space, photons don't interact at all. So this is a whole new kind of quantum technology right on the horizon. And you're going to hear about it first tonight.
So where would you like to start with this?
Well, I guess we should start with the titles, just so that people can do further reading if they like. We're going to be looking at a paper that appeared in Nature called Attractive Photons in a Quantum Nonlinear Medium, and I believe that these authors are from MIT and Harvard.
Yeah, the main authors are Mikhail Lukin and Vladan Vuletic.
Vladan Vuletic.
I'll go with that.
Something like that. These guys always have the hardest names. I don't know why. Maybe you've got to have an exotic name to be a super smart physicist. Then there's another article, which is a more accessible public style article called Little Big Photon by that author, Vladan Vuletic. And both of these, I guess, are from 2013 to 2015. Era.
Yeah, I think the research is 2013. When I was looking through these things, they don't have anything extra published afterwards. It looks like this was something that they found along the way. It looks like they're looking at more practical things a lot from the rest of their research in this sort of quantum optics area. But somewhere along the line, they needed to get something like this going on. And I'm not sure exactly why they only have one paper, since it seems so interesting.
Yeah, it really is. This is a really difficult field. We've been hearing about quantum computing for a long time. But the problem is it's a really difficult thing to do, to get the materials to behave collectively in bound, superimposed, superpositioned kind of states, and to master optics when you're dealing with single photons and statistical actions and trying to turn that into a useful technology. It's not the kind of thing that happens overnight, and they're basically having to invent an entirely new form of technology. It's kind of like around the turn of the 19th century, you can't really build a computer with the technology of that time. So that's sort of where we seem to be with photonics.
Yeah, so they're trying to build things like photonic transistors and things like that so they can actually do real computing stuff, just like you do in silicon, only with photons, and that way you can do all of these other things, right?
There's a lot of pressure in order to develop this technology because I believe that now the silicon chips are getting so small that they're having issues with internal heating because there's always a lot of heat dissipation with electrical currents. And with an optical circuit like this, it's fascinating to look at how photonic crystals and all the other forms of engineering are going to work in this. Okay, so let's talk about the technology. Let's talk about the experiment because it's a complex experiment. And we should probably get into some of the nitty-gritty about it because there's some fascinating principles happening.
Okay, so the main idea here, I think, is they take a photon, right? And maybe a second photon, but they toss it into a cavity resonator. And inside of that cavity resonator, they have the rubidium atoms. We agreed with rubidium, right? And this is at a very low temperature. So you have this really cold gas in there, and you have these photons bouncing around many, many times before they find their way out of the cavity resonator. And over that time, the idea is that there's multiple probabilities or multiple chances for the photon or multiple photons to interact with each one of these atoms. And so when they come out, when they actually come out of the cavity resonator, they come out in a state that is a superposition of all the possibilities of the interactions that they could have had. And what that basically means is you now have, rather than just a photon, you have a quasi-particle photon, which is photon plus a little bit of all of these atoms.
A little bit of the information from its interactions with them, huh?
Yeah, and that is what's going to give us the strange thing. So now when you throw in two photons doing the same stuff, what's going to happen is now that you have the particles being described not by the single photon wave function, but rather this photon plus a little bit of all of this gas, a little bit of all of these atoms. Now that thing has a little bit of mass. So both of these photons that are bouncing around in there have something a little bit like a mass.
It's an effective mass.
I mean, that's how I'm interpreting this. It might be a little bit different, but that's the best way I can interpret this is with an effective mass that you'd see in a second quantization scenario.
Yeah, they said that the effective mass in this equation here, it's like 1,000 times higher than the rest mass energy or the mass energy of the photon that they put in. So it slows down to something like 400 meters per second through the medium, and it acts as if it's 1,000 times more massive than its free space mass.
Well, it sounds like they're using exactly the same sort of technology to do this, or it must be much more advanced by now, but the same sort of technology that they were using to, you know, trap photons. So it's the same idea is that you put these photons into this gas. The gas has been electrified, and that changes in some way the dielectric constant. In this case, they're looking at it at a much more fundamental level than I think the earlier experiments were. I could be wrong, but it seems to me like they are. And so what they're getting out is rather than just trapping a waveform, basically trapping a photon, what they're doing is they're creating these entangled states. So they need to get this into an interesting situation where they've excited these atoms. So they can excite these atoms so that if one photon has excited it, then the other photon doesn't interact with the atom in the same way.
That's right, because when the atom interacts with the first photon, and also the atoms around it can't interact with a photon of the same frequency. So there's this back and forth that happens that acts as if it's binding them together.
This is kind of interesting. I mean, you mentioned this on a previous episode, and that's the reason why I pulled this out. And it seems fairly similar to what I was thinking at that point. It seems like what's happening is pretty similar to what I was thinking was happening at that point, which was that in some strange way, these atoms are acting between the photons the way photons act between electrons. And so the atoms are in some way the force carrier between the two photons. That's a really interesting thing to have happen. In fact, it's the electrons in the atoms that are acting as the force carrier.
Yeah, that was a really interesting aspect of the experiment. So they've got this really cold rubidium gas, and it's inside of an optical resonator so that when they add the photon in, that it will bounce off the inside of the resonator and have a extremely high probability, close to unity, of interacting with the atoms inside before it can escape. And in order to do this, it seems like they're using, now correct me if I'm wrong on this, it seems like they're using a laser to cool the gas, and then they've got, and I guess they're calling that the control laser. And then there's, and then they send, and that gets the atoms down to a ground state. And then they use a different frequency laser in order to jump the outer electrons up to a Rydberg state, where the electron is orbiting so far away from the atom that all of the effects from the inner electron shells become insignificant, and it acts kind of like a hydrogen atom. And these are both stable states. Is that how you understood what we're looking at here?
Yeah, that sounds right. That's actually more detail than I got out of it.
And in these different states, these different kind of stable states, they absorb photons differently. So the same photon, the same kind of frequency won't activate one and the other. And so you end up with this kind of oscillation between these states as the photons pass through. That's sort of the sense I got out of this.
Yeah. So all this stuff that they're doing creates that Rydberg state, which ends up being basically these photons passing through what turns into a dispersive medium that has this strong mutual attraction because of those excited atomic states. And that's what causes the photons to basically bind to each other and create this diphoton state.
Now, the part that I wasn't completely clear on is that the electromagnetically induced transparency comes into play here. Now, I guess that the electromagnetically induced transparency is related to what they call a Rydberg blockade, that the photons aren't allowed to pass through the gas when there's this excited state inside the optical cavity. So that's where your switch is that a subsequent photon will bounce off of this gas. But then I guess when that photon exits from the gas, then they become electromagnetically transparent, and so a signal can pass through it again. So it's like a switch, like an optical switch.
Yeah, they're trying to do something like that because they're trying to create the transistor, right? And that's basically what you need to do. I don't know enough about the electromagnetically induced transparency to understand why it was important in all this. That was one of the issues I was having, is that I didn't actually understand why it was so important. I mentioned it a couple of times, but I had never made the connection very well.
They showed the graph where there's a sort of an ordinary bell curve kind of shape for the absorption spectrum at a given frequency. And then in this special state that they've induced in these really cold atoms, they can create a dip right in the center of that bell curve so that a photon of just the right frequency can pass right through and not get absorbed. And I guess that's where the Rydberg state and the ground state come into play. As I guess maybe in the ground state, it'll absorb the photon. And then in that Rydberg state, it's got this electromagnetically induced transparency that allows that photon to pass.
Yeah, that's one of those interesting things. That happened when the line width of the Rydberg state was larger than the amount of energy over that Rydberg state the guys were actually in. So, I mean, it had something to do with this detuning energy that they were using. So there's a potential, and that potential sort of is a more or less 1/6 law. It's a little more complicated, but it's something like that. Between the two photons. And sort of the strength of that potential, the strength of that coupling, increases with the amount of energy they're putting in and decreases with sort of the size, the energy size, how many energy levels are in that sort of Rydberg state.
They remember the mapping very precisely, like the diameter, basically, of the beam and how it interacted and how it created this this Rydberg blockade. Now, I looked up the Rydberg blockade, and it seemed like that had some really fixed parameters as well. I'd never heard of the Rydberg blockade before. Do you understand that principle? Do you know what's going on there?
No, I don't. This is one of the things that's in my notes for me to look up that I didn't.
Yeah, but apparently this is one of the emerging things in this quantum optical research that's that they find really useful. And I guess that's why they're creating lasers with finer and finer beam widths. because I got the sense that the finest, like they had to get a really fine beam width in order to pass through, and anything larger would create this this state where the photons would bounce off of it, because it wasn't narrow enough to get through this blockade. Now, when they're talking about detuning these states, what is the story with that? There's at least two, like, it looks like they've got at least two different lasers tuned at different frequencies going on. How are they detuning this? What's that all about?
Well, I think they're trying to keep the photons that are traveling in there at a slightly different energy than the atoms. You know, they've got that laser coming in that's exciting the atoms up from the ground state, right? Well, they want the photons that are bouncing around to not be exactly at that energy.
Oh, so the two photons that are acting like they're coupled, they're at a slightly different frequency, is that right?
That's what I believe.
It's a complicated experiment. You know, it's hard to understand it even with the diagrams.
Well, one of the issues with this being a letter, right, is that they have a small number of pages to write up everything that they're doing. And unfortunately, I did not really have enough time to go through and look up all of these different
unique terms to this field of research.
I didn't look up the references. So there are plenty of places here where they're pointing out the place to go to figure out about this thing or that thing or the other thing.
That's right.
And I didn't really have the time to go through and do that. I flipped through an old quantum optics book, and I haven't got a lot of this out of it. So that wasn't helping me very much either, which is not at all surprising because, you know, this is pretty new stuff. It's not the stuff you expect to find in a book.
Yeah, it's pretty brand spanking new. Well, one of the things, the shows that I'd love to talk about in the future is to get more into this electromagnetically induced transparency phenomenon, because if I understand it properly, that using the right materials and the right type of stimulation using, I guess, lasers and maybe even an electrical charge, you can make an opaque material, like a metal material that's got specific metamaterial properties. You can make it transparent to a certain wavelength, a very narrow bandwidth of wavelength. And how fascinating would that be, to have an opaque sheet of a material and then be able to stimulate it and shine a laser on it and be able to see through it? That sounds like something out of a science fiction movie to me.
Well, it is probably something out of a science fiction movie. That's wrong. They don't think this sort of stuff up with science fiction movies.
Oh, actually, there was a book from the 1950s that I read one time that talked about a technology like this. And I honestly don't know what to make of that book, but it was fascinating to me. The author described a beam shining on this metal surface that made it transparent. You could suddenly see through it.
That's a little bit different than what you're talking about, right? That sort of thing, like you can do something to make yourself see through a wall or something like that. That's fairly common. Something that science fiction authors don't often get are very specific things that actually happen that seem a little bit less like magic, but are really cool.
Yeah.
Right. So that's where the electromagnetically induced transparency is, right? Whereas you know, I can shine a thing at a wall and I can catch the people doing whatever it is they're doing on the other side. You know, that's one of these themes that somebody probably pulled that out of a myth somewhere and it made its rounds until it found its way into the science fiction literature, which happens a lot.
But nowadays, it looks like in the lab, they're developing these special, of course, you wouldn't be able to do it to a wall. You've got to have a very special material with very special properties, and it probably has to be in some kind of quantum state and under very controlled conditions. But then you can create this opening in the band gap, and it will allow a certain frequency of light to come through. And they're exploiting that effect right here at a quantum atomic scale.
Yeah, what I'm saying is that something this specific is not this thing you see in literature.
Yeah. Well, they're not physicists, you know.
Yeah, there aren't enough physicists writing science fiction. So there are ways you could build this into your story that aren't quite as cool as being able to just open up a
window and a wall.
Which would be nice. It would be nice to be able to have a wall that turns into a window and then turns back into a wall, especially if your neighbor never shuts off his porch light.
He also mentioned in here something that caught my eye, is that with the right frequency of stimulation of these gas atoms, that they could make the photons behave as if they had a negative mass as well, like an effective negative mass.
Yeah, they should be able to do that as well. Yeah.
Now, in practice, what is that? What would that be like? What does a photon with a negative mass act like?
I'm not really sure what a photon with a negative mass would act like. So you have to think of this as an inertial mass, right? So that means that whenever you give the photon a kick, however you're kicking a photon.
It would move in the opposite, towards your foot.
That's right.
So cool.
But I'm not sure how you'd kick a photon.
Well, I'm guessing that with these atoms bouncing around and interacting with a photon, that I guess it would just be sort of like the movie played. Let me think. Would it be played backwards? Yeah, I guess that when the photon's supposed to be pushing it away, it would actually be attracted to it.
Well, something like that. I mean, in general, I think what you'd say is that with the positive mass, they're binding. And what that effectively means is that when they leave the cavity, those events where they leave the cavity are correlated. Or not just correlated, but they're...
Simultaneous.
Yeah, they're simultaneous. They're bunching. So, you know, you'll have nothing going on, and then when one comes out, you'll have another one come out. So you're throwing these things in uniformly, one every... I have no idea how quickly to do it. You know, let's say one every nanosecond or something, and they're coming out two every 2 nanoseconds or something like that. So they actually, you know, bind together. So if you had, say, zero mass, you might expect a more random distribution, right, where a bunch of them are coming out at the same time. Or, you know, they're coming out maybe a Poisson distribution or something like that. Click, clickety, click, click, clickety, click, click, click. Click, sort of like a Geiger counter or something like that. So they randomly hit enough of these rubidium atoms to find their way out of the cavity, and then they come out. I wonder what would happen with the negative mass. You might think that what would happen is instead of this binding, they'd repel each other some way. And how that would show up in the detector, I'm not sure, but you might end up with more even spacing because of that. I'm not sure, but I'd expect that if what you're doing is the opposite of binding, you know, you're going to try to separate yourselves out a little more.
I wonder, you know, if they're both acting like they have a negative mass, then maybe those effects would cancel and they'd still be attracted. I think I saw something in the paper about him saying that regardless of what, if their mass was positive or negative, they still acted like they were strongly bound.
Okay, well then I'm completely off.
But no, I think what you're talking about is definitely what happens, and what we saw in the Robert Forward papers, where when you have a positive mass interacting with a negative mass, they do act in that like kind of perverse manner. Mm-hmm. But I think when you've got two of them interacting with each other, that they kind of invert a second time and act just like a normal mass interaction would happen.
It could happen that way. Yeah, I mean, normally what I'd be thinking of is something like if you had, say, an electron in a material with a negative mass, then the current would go in the opposite direction that you'd expect.
Ah, okay.
But, you know, now I'm just trying to figure out what that would mean for photons, which aren't doing anything with the charge. So I don't know what the real forces are other than this interaction force. And this interaction potential that they give doesn't have an explicit effective mass term. Instead, it has this comparison between the detuning and the resonance spread.
Yeah, so it seems like the photons are adopting the characteristics of the atoms by virtue of this really strong coupling between the photon and the atoms, so that the photons, like sort of through proxy, act as if they're attracted just like the rubidium atoms do.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that. So the way I'm interpreting it is that rubidium atoms are the force carriers. So it doesn't seem to me to be really a situation where the photons are attracted to each other because the rubidium atoms are attracted to each other. Instead, it's just that the ways the photons can interact with the rubidium atoms create a force between the photons.
You know, now that you mention that, you reminded me of a interview that I saw in one of the articles online about this, where I can't remember which one of the authors it was. I think that it was Mikhail Lukin was saying that this is like a new state of matter, because it's a coupled system of photon atom. And you can't really distinguish one or the other because they're acting in sympathy.
Yeah, that's going to be true. Actually, that sort of brings me to a question that I don't have an answer to. And that is, how do these interacting photons compare to the interactions between photons in the high-energy physics environment? So in the early universe, supposedly, photons had enough energy that they actually interacted with each other.
I think that might have been through the pair production mechanism, but I'm not entirely sure. It is a totally different kind of thing, though.
But my question is how similarly does this act to that?
Well, that sounds like an excellent topic for another show, because that's something that I would love to get more deeply into, is the weirdness of photon actions in really high energy regimes like that.
Yeah, let's look at that. But, I mean, I don't think we're going to find a lot for the show on that the particular question I was asking, because I don't think anybody's asked it, or if they have, they haven't answered it.
Oh, yeah. We might be able to find out something about, you know, what we know about extremely high-energy photon interactions, because they've been doing all that amazing stuff with, like, quark-gluon plasmas that simulate the conditions of the Big Bang and that kind of thing. But how it bears on this, I doubt anybody's even thought of it yet.
That's one of the things I was thinking, is that maybe this would be an interesting system to look at to try to see what sort of things would happen. Maybe it's not, but maybe it is.
Well, let's find out.
Yeah, I'll just write somebody. Everything will be fine.
One of the ideas that came up when I was doing some cursory reading about this that really caught my imagination was the idea of having these quantum states of a material like these rubidium gases, or maybe even a solid state, maybe like a photonic crystal, and having photon interactions and pathways all laid out like a complete circuit within the material, sort of like almost like a silicon chip.
Well, I think that's where they really want to go with stuff like this, right? I'm not sure how you get there from here, but it sounds like, from reading that little big photon, that's where they want to go.
And that it's really intriguing to me, because in that kind of situation, it's almost as if the circuitry becomes pure energy. You know, you've got these interactions happening with just the light energy itself. So instead of having electrons following, you know, conductors and everything and going through these doped silicon materials, you'd have the entire, I guess you'd call it a chip, but the energy interactions would be the actual circuitry.
Yeah, so, well, with the quantum processor, you might be able to get away with just having a bunch of these things in gaseous form. I'm not completely sure, but if they're all acting as one coupled system, that's what you need. And you might not care too much about some of the other implementation details.
Yeah, I guess at some point they're going to be able to create like a solid piece of material with these, maybe even gases like this, just trapped with maybe 100 atoms here, 100 atoms there, and the light signals passing through it would all be, you know, activated and creating the computations inside the material.
Yeah, and that would be really good for the quantum computation stuff. And then, you know, you'd be able to have really, really good privacy for your iPhone.
Yeah, the quantum cryptography, I guess, is a big motivation behind a lot of this kind of research. Something to do with, I'm not sure how that exactly works. Something to do with the entanglement means that, I guess, only the two entangled particles have the information to break the key, to sort of unlock the information. And if you break that entanglement, then that information's lost, so your access to the information is gone forever.
Something like that is what I recall.
Yeah, you can't snoop on an entangled system, right? Because if you do anything to snoop, then you break the entanglement.
Yeah, and then you can, you know, factor some primes. I think that's pretty much what they figure out how to do with a quantum computer. Cryptography and playing with primes. Actually, that's what they really want the quantum computer for cryptography, is they want to be able to factor large primes very quickly. That way they can, because most cryptography is based on, you know, they want to factor integers, right, into their primes so that they can do all of their weird cryptography stuff. Because that's the way cryptography basically works, is, you know, you use large prime numbers to to hide information from other people.
Do you have a sense of where this is all going? Like, if they develop a quantum computer, I did a little bit of reading about it, and it seemed like what a quantum computer can do is sort of fundamentally different than what we would want an ordinary microchip to do. Do you know what we're going to be able to do with quantum computers that we can't do with current computers that's so exciting?
Well, those were the things that they basically can do right now. Once they have a quantum computer, you know, working, I'm sure they'll find other things to do. But most likely, it won't be the sort of things that most people do on their computers. It's not going to create a new generation of game consoles, okay?
Okay.
You know, you're not going to have a really, really excellent version of Microsoft Excel. So it's not going to do a whole lot for the stuff that you and I care about in day-to-day life. Really, as far as what they have right now, it's only going to be really interesting for certain particular problems. And like I said, we've basically gone through the list of problems that quantum computers actually solve right now, or that we know they solve right now. But once they have one online, people will figure out newer and newer ways to do things with them. There will probably be some sort of revolution in manufacturing. They'll probably be able to find really good ways to do simulations, and so that we can get much better materials, we can get much better designs and things like that.
Oh, because it can do quantum computing, it can sort of compute calculations that have to do with quantum properties. And so we'd then open up a whole new era of like quantum engineering. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, yeah, stuff like that. I think there also might be some interesting things that happen in just regular simulations where you need to do massive parallel computations and stuff like that. I think for certain problems, you're probably going to be able to figure out algorithms that work a lot better on the quantum computer than on a regular computer. But for the most part, and that includes most things that you'd be doing in an industrial environment, I don't think you're going to find very many things that actually are an improvement using the quantum computer. In fact, a lot of things, just because you have another interesting problem with a quantum computer, will be worse. And the interesting problem with a quantum computer is, once you've done the computation, how do you get the information out? Because you're basically only measuring a projection of that state, right? But you need to measure the state. The answer is the state that comes out, and the state is a bunch of complex numbers. But you can only really measure the probabilities that come out of those complex numbers.
It sounds like more of a research tool than a practical device.
That's the way it's going to be at first. Eventually, they'll figure it out. Obviously, now that people can do weak measurements and things like that, you probably got a better way to pull information out about the actual wave function. So you've probably got a better way to read the information than they did when they first invented this. Because when they first invented this, the only thing that they could think of is, okay, if I need to get this number to within 10%, I need to run the program at least 100 times. If I need to get it within 1%, I need to run it 10,000 times. If I need to get it to within 0.1%, I need to run it 1,000,000 times. At which point, the advantages to using the quantum computer sort of dissipate.
But I got the idea that it could do some things like instantaneously that our current computers could take forever to do.
Yes, it can. So there are a few things that it can really do well, but sort of general purpose things, it doesn't do well.
I wonder how it's gonna relate to artificial intelligence, because it seems like the biological mind is often just like a superposition. You know, you've got all these different ideas and thoughts and conflicting possibilities. You know, that would be hard. It seems like they're really hard to emulate with silicon and electronics.
Yeah, but the whole thing about your brain is that it has a way of choosing these things in the end, right? Mm-hmm. And that's basically the most primitive part of your brain. So, you know, you're wandering around, you say, you know, I've got $10, I can either get a sandwich or I can pay my electric bill or whatever it is you need to do. I guess around here you never have a $10 electric bill. I know I did have $10 electric bills in Colorado during most of the year.
You must have had a gas heater. Well, if quantum computing is so good with probabilities, maybe it's a whole different way of thinking. Like, maybe a quantum computer could figure out the most probable way to get a certain result.
I think there are going to be a lot of things like that that people actually figure out. So, like I said, right now they don't have a lot of really interesting algorithms for quantum computers.
Right, they got to build it first, right?
Yeah, but a big thing is that the only thing you can do for a quantum computer is write an algorithm and then make a mathematical proof that your algorithm will run. The mathematical proof that your algorithm, when run on a quantum computer, will give you the result that you want to have, right? So there's a subset of people that are interested in algorithm design, that are really interested in algorithm design for computers that don't exist, and I can't really play with my algorithm to see what's actually going on. I don't know exactly how small that group is, but I think it's pretty small.
Right, it's pretty theoretical, because right now all we can do is try to anticipate what they're going to be able to do.
Yeah, and I mean, they're going to get there. They're going to do amazing things that we are not even thinking of. They might do really interesting things with AI, because, you know, so far people really haven't.
Yeah, it seems like the wrong solution to the problem.
I'm so far out by now. I think we've been talking for 20 minutes off the subject.
It's all right. it was fun to kind of consider where this might all be leading. We'll probably get back to other quantum optics subjects that are appearing in the press now, because it is a really hot area of research, and they're doing magical things, it seems, almost every year. And one of the things that fascinates me is all of this like metamaterials and photonic crystals and all that kind of jazz. So this is just one of the pieces of the puzzle, and maybe we'll put a few more of them together as the program goes on.
Yeah, we'll definitely get to a couple of those. Have we got everything you need to talk about, Randy?
Absolutely. I really appreciate your help helping me try to get my head around this.
It was nice talking to you, and I'm very sad that I don't understand more than I did when I started. But that's
oh, okay. I'm sorry.
I really missed the boat somewhere on here, because I thought I was understanding it for a little while, and then it was
yeah, gone. Me too. I read the paper, and I seemed to feel like I was kind of on top of it, and then I went and got a cup of coffee and lost all of it.
All right. Okay. Well, I'll talk to you again next week. How's that?
Sounds great, Jim. Thank you for your time.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.